All right. Hello, everyone. My name is Moritz. I'm happy to present you our work, HeapHopper, Bringing Bounded Model Checking to Heap Implementation Security. This is collaborative work with this awesome people you can see right here from UC Santa Barbara, Arizona State University, and the University of Iowa. I'd like to start by giving an example of our problem. Why is it so hard getting the heap right? Why is it so hard to detect metadata corruption, prevent metadata corruption? And why can it be a severe impact to the heap security if you can just override the metadata itself? So the example you can see on the left here is an attack discovered originally by Chris Evans. And the really interesting thing about it is it's just using a single null byte overflow. That's interesting because in C, strings are ended by just a null byte, and that often leads to this off by one problem where you forgot to account for the ending null byte. And so you have the scenario where you have, in this case, three allocated chunks. One gets free, and then you have an overflow into some metadata field, in this case the size, by just this single null byte. And this doesn't give you any control over user data in the heap, but it modifies the actual metadata of the chunk itself. And when we follow this attack through, you can see that this single null byte overflow leads to some forgotten update in the fourth step, where the redundant data which is stored in the fourth chunk, or sorry, in the C chunk, is not updated correctly, which automatically leads to the problem that in the sixth case, we have the C chunk and the B1 chunk freed, it'll have a wrong previous size stored in the C chunk, ultimately leading to the merging of those chunks to prevent memory fragmentation, and it will forget that there's actually a chunk in the middle, as you can see, the B2 chunk here. So we basically get from a single primitive, which is very weak, just a null byte overflow, to a complete control over a chunk in memory. And that really showcases how easy it can be just by overriding metadata to gain even further control. And what was interesting about this attack as well, not only that it shows how a really complex attack can work out on the heap, Chris Evans also came up with a patch for this attack. So he was just introducing a new consistency check that just makes sure the previous size and size of those two chunks are always consistent. And when this patch was introduced, Chris Evans posted a blog post about it and stating this sentence that we can see right here, which says, "If we finally nail off the off by one null byte overrides in the glibc heap, only time will tell." So there's a really great uncertainty if these checks are introduced in the libc, if they're really efficient, if they really do that job. And the answer to answer his question, it's no, right? So after a long going back and forward of merging this patch finally into glibc, the maintainers agreed that it was a good patch and it was merged. And just after a couple days later, somebody else posted an attack that would bypass this new patch and would make the attack still possible. So this is the motivation for our work, is manually handling this dynamic memory is a hard job for a developer. So bugs are very common, and the metadata itself is a really valuable target for an attacker because he's completely independent of the actual user data in the heap. And all these checks that try to prevent this, they're really done in a non-systematic way. It's more like a cat and mouse game, that's people are proposing patches and other people try to bypass them again. So we came up with a tool we call HeapHopper, which is trying to address this problem in a very systematic way by using bounded model checking to evaluate in case of there are vulnerabilities in a program that affect the memory safety of the heap. How does the heap protect itself against metadata corruption, and that would ultimately lead to hijacking the control flow, for example. And you can see HeapHopper can be split into three main parts, which go from horizontally here from left to right. and I will go into each one of them. So let's start off by showing our model. What is our interaction model, which corresponds to the left part of heap hopper right here. And when we look at the heap is essentially kind of a state. So the heap builds the state of our model. And the state is present in memory as the metadata that it contains, for example, the mapped chunks, the allocated ones, the freed. All this information is stored somewhere in memory and represents its state. And whenever we do an operation on this state, let's say we call an API call, as there's malloc and free, or we operate on the memory of this heap. So we store something in the chunks that we allocated, or we have a misusage in this case, let's say an overflow. We modify the state as well, so we get a new state. The problem with this is the actual internal state is very implementation dependent. There's no real API or no real standard for that. The only standard that's given is the API itself. So the only thing we know is there's a clear contract between what you put into malloc and what you get back. So what we do is we are pretty much completely agnostic of the internal state of the heap. We only observe those transactions and see the input and output and refer state from that. So we don't have to know the actual structure of the metadata of the heap inside. And the transactions, which are essential building blocks, we split them in two different categories. They are usages of the heap, as for example malloc or free, and they are misusages. So they represent common vulnerabilities that are represented that are present in current programs, as for example an overflow, a use after free, a double free, and a fake free. I think the first three of them are pretty common. I maybe should explain a little bit more the last one. So a fake free, in our sense, means that you pass something to free that is not actually ever allocated. That could be you store a pointer somewhere to a chunk, it gets overwritten, and you pass this pointer to free, which just represents some memory somewhere else in memory. All right, I will give a showcase of two of them, one usage and one misusage. So if you look at malloc, it's just the transaction itself and gets a size parameters input. And in a concrete execution, this is a constant value. And for us, in our model, we put there a symbolic value. And this symbolic value needs to have distinct values, so it's not completely arbitrary. That's just because how we check the model later, and we'll get into that. And what we get returned is a chunk. So it's an allocated chunk, and it has some metadata attached to it. This could be stored, as we can see here, in the actual chunk memory itself. It could also be stored somewhere else in the heap. And it has some attributes to it, for example, the address as well as the size. And these come from the actual symbolic value we pass into it. So what we get is what we call a symbolic allocation. That is an allocation that is not at a fixed address, but at a symbolic address, which is dependent on what the initial value was. And of course, we have some constraints on these attributes, which result from different code paths in the libc. Let's say the libc differs its behavior depending on how much memory you allocate. So the chunk you get returned is also dependent on these different code paths, therefore dependent on their initial input. And yeah, what it also does, of course, is it modifies the heap state, right? So to give an example of a misusage, let's have a look at the use after free. So the use after free is basically you have a free chunk, which was already passed to free, and now you operate on this chunk. For example, you write to its data, which is illegal, so it's a vulnerability, it shouldn't happen. And what happened, how we implement that is we take some symbolic data, some fresh new symbolic data, and we overwrite the content of this chunk of the symbolic data, as you can see right here. And of course, in case there's any metadata stored there, we also modify the heap state. So we have all these transactions, and they are our building blocks. So to build the complete models, we take those transactions, and we build permutations of those. And of course, we are bounded by a certain depth. We just, let's say, take, for example, a maximum of 6 transactions next after each other. And yeah, when we have all those permutations, we try to make some performance improvement by filtering with certain rules. So we consider the semantics of each of those transactions. And for example, we make sure there's at least one misusage of the heap in there, because we assume that if you just use benign or usages, you won't end up in a corrupted state. And what we do next is we transform this to actual source code, to actual C source code, and we have those placeholders where we will later put the symbolic memory and compile those to binaries. So now we have a whole stack of these binaries representing all those possible combinations of the transactions. And this is finally passed to our second step, which is the model checking. So in the model checking, which represents the middle part of Heap Hopper, we use symbolic execution. And what we do is we get the library, or the actual allocator is a shared library, and we execute our code as well as the code of the shared library. That entails that we have to emulate system calls. That's just because we're using Anger Framework as our symbolic execution engine, and that's just required there. And one important part about our symbolic execution is that we use depth-first search instead of depth-first search, so that we reach. So our idea is that if we reach a certain state, let's say we want to bypass a certain check, we're done, right? We just want to find one way to bypass that in the concrete scenario. So this gives us just a faster result. This just has a better performance. And the question is, what do we want to check while we model check? What are we looking for? What are the properties we're looking for? And we came up with these 3 or maybe 4 different corrupted states we are looking for, which is an overlapping allocation, meaning 2 chunks returned by malloc are separately allocated, have some common memory in heap that they overlap. And a non-heap allocation means malloc returns some chunk, some memory that is not actually in the heap segment, that's not actually its own memory. And finally, we have an arbitrary write, which for us means we have some code in the allocator that's executed, and it issues an actual write. For example, it wants to update its own metadata, and it's basing that on a symbolic address that was introduced by us before with one of the misusages. So this represents a typical scenario where an attacker controls the metadata, which is used for one of those writes, and it gives them an arbitrary write. So when we identify one of the states, we store this result, and as a final step with all those found corrupted states, we want to give the user an output. And therefore, we in our last step, we generate those what we call proof of concept codes. It just takes the initial source code, which we compile to binary and execute it symbolically, and we take the information we got from the symbolic execution and bring them together. And what it would look like would be, let's say, look at this example, which is a C source code. And what you see here in color is stuff that was initially just a placeholder, was just placed symbolically in there, and is now some concrete values. And what you can see is that, for example, in the first yellow line up there, there's the address of write target used. And that just displays something. What we have to look out for is there could be addresses of symbolic in our symbolic memory space that corresponds to some objects, or even correspond to some offset between objects. And we have to identify those and get the actual object that was referenced there and place that into the source code. Because if we now recompile this source code, should still follow the same code path and get to the same corrupted state displaying what we found earlier. So this was the whole trace from our initial transactions over how we build those models and model check them and finally output the proof of concept codes. I want to say that this is the first step one of the first steps in this direction, addressing these problems. So there are several limitations for us. One big percent limitation is, of course, we are bound by certain depth. We can only execute a certain amount of, or we can just create permutations for a certain amount of transactions. And while we are executing this symbolically, we are also bound, of course, by memory and time. That's just what's implied by using symbolic execution there. To take a look at our evaluation, we made a broad evaluation on different allocators. These are three different allocators and five different versions. You can look for the details in there in our paper. What I wanted to point out here is to take a look at those findings we see between ptmalloc 2.23 and ptmalloc 2.26. So this is the one below is an updated version of the first one, and it had a lot of additional security checks introduced. So we assumed, we thought there would be a lot less possible ways to achieve those corrupted states. And what we could see here is that actually it looks fairly similar. But for this one, we can see how one of the examples in ptmalloc 2.23 is now an unconstrained write instead of constrained write. What that means is the memory location we write to has no constraints anymore. So there's no values that have to be there so that the write is actually done. And when we look deeper into that, what happened here is we malloced fake free and freed. So with the fake free, we introduced a symbolic pointer into the heap. And when the second free was done, this void pointer was used to dereference and write there. And so we thought, hey, that's odd. Actually, there were more checks. At least it shouldn't get worse. So we discovered there was a new structure introduced into the glibc heap, or into ptmalloc, which is called tcache. And tcache is basically kind of a pre-hook to the previous structures that should help improve the performance. And this structure doesn't do any or almost non-consistency checks. So which was handled by the previous structure before and was checked is now not checked anymore. And this is, I think, a great showcase on how HeapHopper is able to identify those kind of implications you get by introducing those structures. I also want to look very briefly on the Poisson's null byte. So the challenging thing about this is it has a very, very high depth. Like a lot of actions have to perform, a lot of transactions have to be performed until you reach this corrupted state. So it's very challenging for HeapHopper because of this high depth. And it has a very constrained attack vector, but just along this null byte overflow. So what we just wanted to see if HeapHopper would identify this attack given such a model. And it was actually, it found the attack. And so we were curious, okay, there was a patch introduced by Chris Evans solely based on his analysis. So what would happen when we verify the patch with HeapHopper? And what happened, we actually found the same bypass that was posted just a couple of days after the patch was introduced. And I think that's a great showcase how HeapHopper can help here in that case to verify the implications of new patches, even for very technical, very complex topics or attacks like this one. And yeah, we developed our own patch, which reduces the amount of interactions and therefore helps to improve the original patch. You can find the details in the paper as well. And yeah, we tried that as well with HeapHopper and was actually not able to find a bypass. We tried to upstream this patch and made the experience how hard it is to actually change or introduce those security checks into the heap itself or into the libc itself, just because it's always a trade-off between performance and security, and people that develop heaps are really very valuing the performance. So yeah, I think there were two great showcases how HeapHopper can be used in practice to help improve just the development of those heaps. So with that being said, that's it for my talk, and thank you very much for your attention.
Hi there. Great work. looked like a fun paper that I'll have to add to my reading list. Quick question. So all of the allocators you looked at were allocating the metadata right next or in line with the allocated objects, right? Did you also look at disjoint allocators, like the one in FreeBSD, DieHard, DieHarder, or any of the like Windows 10 allocators that are a little bit more resilient against these kinds of attacks?
Unfortunately, we have not yet. It's very interesting to look at those. We expect HeapHopper, of course, to be not as efficient as with the actual inline metadata because it's harder to corrupt those heaps. Yeah, that will be some interesting future work. Yeah, that. So the actual transactions that are interesting here would be, for example, fake freeze, double freeze, those type of attacks, not overflows and use after freeze, of course. Yeah.
Do we have more questions for the speaker? All right, then I'll throw in one question that I had. Maybe you didn't cover in your talk. So when you perform the symbolic execution, is there any strategy in terms of selecting which variables that you should symbolize, or it's just all the input that may affect the allocation?
So there's one interesting thing is, let's say we have those writes, right? That's a very interesting thing. We try to concretize those to controlled memory, representing what an attacker would do in case he gets control over some kind of pointer and he needs to pass certain checks. He would point that back to his own memory. That's what we try to represent there, yeah.
Okay. All right, let's thank the speaker one more time.